This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, amidst the Trump policies that are cracking down on immigrants, separating families, putting them in cages, there's a ray of hope coming from the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We speak with the attorney who's bringing cases against the Trump administration.
The U.S. government continues to impose harsh sanctions against Venezuela.
Their goal is to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro and to capture Venezuelans' great supply of natural resources, oil, gold, diamonds, to run that country on the benefit of U.S. capital.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, it's great to see you after our summer hiatus where we've been alternating weeks.
Well, we're back together, you, me, and Jeff Brady. It's a nice reunion. We've got some good guests today, but first I wanted to talk about Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, I know you've, last time I saw you, you were hot to uncover some juicy morsels.
Well, we got Phil Giraldi, an ex-CIA agent. We interviewed him. You can get it at Phil Giraldi, and then Google Phil Giraldi and Law and Disorder, and it'll come up. That was 2 weeks ago. Giraldi predicted that the whole thing would be covered up, and actually, that's what I think is happening.
I've seen nothing in the news recently.
Nothing in the news. I don't know where the investigation is going to go. So what's my takeaway on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal? I think, first and foremost, we have to understand that Jeffrey Epstein was a billionaire, liquid assets of $560 million, plus all the property he owned, including a private island in the Caribbean.
He had the means.
He was a billionaire.
Right.
And this is the most significant thing, I think, that he was part of the ruling class. When he served his light jail sentence for child prostitution in Florida in 2008, he came back to New York and he was welcomed by high society. Welcomed. Why? Well, the guy was part of the Trilateral Commission, a very prestigious think tank. He was part of the Council for Foreign Relations, another prestigious think tank. He donated millions of dollars to Harvard. He socialized and hobnobbed with artists and intellectuals, scientists, politicians. I think that, you know, his $71 million mansion in Manhattan, which he was given for a dollar, I think that when people came there, they were filmed and recorded. Every room in that mansion was wired.
I get where you're going.
Yeah,
like
well,
J. Edgar Hoover.
He was blackmailing people. Who was he blackmailing people for? Phil Giraldi thought that he was doing it for the Mossad. That's the Israeli CIA. Or he may have been doing it for the CIA. But in any case, he was part of the whole government operation. And that answers the question, why are they covering it up? Because he was one of them. What happened to him in jail here in Manhattan, we'll never know. I don't think we'll ever know. The medical examiner's report was not released, only the conclusions that he hung himself. Well, I don't know how he could have hung himself. There was a report that he had fractured his hyoid bone, which is the top bone in your spine. And, you know, I used to do medical malpractice litigation. And the only way you can fracture that bone, and this has been confirmed by a number of private doctors, is from strangulation. So did he commit suicide? Was he assassinated? I don't know. I don't think we'll ever know. But the takeaway is that he was one of them, and they're covering it up.
What I find fascinating, Michael, is that years ago in the early 2000s, Epstein was also on the advisory board at Harvard for their Society for Mind, Brain, and Behavior. And he actually held or hosted seminars on evolutionary biology that senior administrators of Harvard attended, including Lawrence Summers, then Harvard's president. Fascinating, though, that topic would dovetail with the disturbed behavior that he engaged in, the criminal behavior that he engaged in for years.
Yeah.
There are a lot of ironies in this case, and I hope that at least for the sake of the many victims of his, that he will be held accountable after his death.
I hope so. I read a well-drafted complaint by attorney Thomas Francis Meagher of Princeton, New Jersey. And if you Google Thomas Francis Meagher, Jane Doe, you'll come up with the case. And the complaint was brought on behalf of a 13-year-old girl called Jane Doe to hide her true identity. And it alleged that both Trump and Epstein serially raped this 13-year-old girl and then slapped her around and threatened her with death if she told anybody. And she bravely brought the complaint, and then she withdrew it.
Mm.
But the complaint to me had a ring of truth, and I would suggest to people that they Google it and make up their own mind about what these two characters who knew each other, they were chums. Trump called Epstein, quote, a terrific guy who liked girls, preferably on the young side. That's a quote also. They were pals. Epstein was part of the whole ruling apparatus. And let's see whether the cover-up continues.
And one final note, it's not just on this continent. Prince Andrew of the United Kingdom has also played some kind of role in this.
Yeah, he was an economic ambassador from Great Britain. And after his name was associated with Epstein, they fired him. Let's see what comes up on this. Stay tuned. Three years ago, Donald Trump ran on a racist, nativist platform, scapegoating Muslims and Mexicans. He lost the popular vote but won the election through the Electoral College and began implementing his scapegoating. First, he banned Muslims because the Supreme Court ignored his campaign statements and ruled that he had a right to do it under national security. The Trump policy has been deliberately cruel, separating children from their families, caging immigrants in cold cement-floored cells, rightly called concentration camps, and now attempting to deny non-citizen residents who are here medical care and other benefits. Attorney Bahir Azmi joins us today. He's the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. The CCR is involved in a number of cases seeking to protect immigrants. We will also speak with Attorney Azmi about the current status of the offshore prison island on Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where men who are trapped there are in limbo. They have yet to receive trials. They've been there for many, many years. And last, we will speak with Bahir about the Al-Shamari versus Khaki case, where the U.S. government farmed out torture to a private corporation.
Bahir Azmi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. I was happy to be here.
Great. On August 27th, the Center for Constitutional Rights and other attorneys filed a lawsuit in federal court seeking to block the Trump administration's proposed so-called public charge rule before it takes effect. The challenge to this rule says it, quote, weaponized the social safety net. What would be the consequences if this rule goes into effect?
The consequences are enormously far-reaching and to some extent have already happened. So what the rule, it's highly technical, but what the rule attempts to do is identify a very broad category of public benefits that individuals receive and denominate the people who receive those benefits as a, quote, public charge, and then on that basis deny them the possibility of becoming, adjusting their status to become either a lawful permanent resident or to transform their lawful permanent residency status, that is having a green card, into becoming a citizen. This will affect thousands of lawful immigrants, and I think reflects very clearly the administration's attack on all immigrants, particularly, non-white immigrants, who are the predominant target of this rule. because to, you know, to the extent the administration had argued all of their other practices were designed against unlawful immigrants, those maybe who cross illegally, though we should bear in mind that seeking asylum is lawful. This attacks people here who are lawfully present, who just happen to need to supplement their income through the receipt of critical benefits that could include things like Medicare or food stamps.
So we're talking about a wealth test that favors the relatively well-off people and, as you referenced, white people.
Precisely. So there's no doubt, and you know the evidence will show that its target and its actual population, impacted population, are non-white immigrants, and it's designed to ensure that these non-white immigrants do not achieve a kind of permanent residency status or citizenship here. It is designed to signal and operationalize this notion that they are undeserving of American citizenship or residency.
Now, does this term, does the new rule seek to redefine the term public charge, and if so, how?
It does. So there has been a statute on the books for a long time that makes certain people ineligible for this adjusted immigration status if they become a public charge. The categories of benefits that were counted towards that were extremely narrow. And so what the rule attempts to do is broaden the scope to innumerable public benefits that anyone is receiving or potentially may have received in the past beyond what the statute would permit. The statute has a very limited scope. It also includes these really crazy subjective and arbitrary factors like English language proficiency. How you determine whether or not someone has proficiency in the English language is not identified as up to some random bureaucrat. And in that English language proficiency piece, I think you see a real, you know, a real tell about who they are targeting. So, you know, we argue, among other things, that this violates the statute because it expands the definition beyond what the statute permits. It violates 40 years of regulatory practice and definition. It violates the Equal Protection Clause because it is intended to and does target non-white individuals. It violates the Administrative Procedure Act because it's arbitrary and capricious and ignored all of the evidence that suggests this is a terrible idea and will not accomplish any reasonable regulatory goals. And I should say this is part of a broader effort. There are a number of lawsuits across the country, including by attorneys general in California and New York, attacking this really cruel law.
So what will happen to these people? Will they be deported?
Potentially. If they can't adjust their status to lawful permanent residency, they may be. The ordinary course is if you're here on an authorized visa and meet the criteria for a green card, you can apply. But if you're denied the opportunity to transfer, adjust your status to a green card, and your visa runs out, be it a student visa or a kind of work visa, you won't be authorized to stay. And so it's denominating who can stay and who can become a member of the political and legal community in this country based on how much money you have. And, you know, the other really ugly effect of this, and this is an effect that's, I meant to note in response to Heidi's first question, that's happening now. Because even the rumor of this rule, the idea that this rule might be happening, caused immigrants all over the country to be put in this terrible choice about receiving necessary benefits or protecting their immigration status and protecting their families. So it puts individuals in a choice between, you know, potentially saving their life. We had one community member testified about how she needed Medicare to treat her ovarian cancer while she was applying for a green card. And now she would be put in a choice between having status and staying with her family or life-saving medical care. And that's exactly the cruelty that this rule is designed to impose.
All this in the effort to make America white again.
Precisely. I mean, these are all a collection of efforts to whiten America, sort of rid it of non-white immigrant populations, and favor those, as the president said, from countries like Norway, not from places that the administration called whole countries. I mean, this is precisely the agenda: by excluding people at the border, mass raids to deport, and now this, even for people who are lawfully present.
And to that end, in CCR's Al Otro Lado v. Nielsen case, you brought a class action documenting cases in which the Customs and Border Patrol denied asylum seekers who presented themselves at points of entry on the U.S.-Mexican border the right to seek protection in the USA. Tell us about this. What kind of illegal conduct is the USA engaged in?
Yes, so all sorts of efforts to basically shut down the southern border. And we've brought three lawsuits in response to Customs and Border Protection's illegal conduct. In the Al Otro Lado case, we saw that at ports of entry, these are, you know, places where there are customs agents that receive individuals, people who are coming to the United States because they have a job there and present their passport and come into work, or people who present and want to seek asylum. And for those who seek asylum, Customs and Border Protection have engaged in all sorts of unlawful activity to deny them even the opportunity to apply. In the first phase of their conduct, they were lying, saying, you know, Trump has ended asylum, telling people that, well, if you apply, we'll take your children. That actually, of course, ultimately turned out to be true, coercing individuals to withdraw their applications. More recently, they've been engaged in this practice that they call metering, which is a euphemism that just keeps people waiting for weeks and weeks and weeks in dangerous conditions on the Mexican side because they tell people we don't have room. And that's false. There's plenty of capacity. But it's avowedly, you know, a practice to, they said, deter immigrants from coming. They basically said if we let them in, more will come. So we have to stop them from coming.
Yeah, it's the kind of policies that Trump's advisor, Stephen Miller, cooked up. I read an essay where he was described as having the soul of a Nazi.
Yeah. I mean, there's a darkness there. And this is, you know, combined with the intentional cruelty of the family separation policy, the idea that they would revoke temporary protected status, that's a status given to people from a certain country where there's a humanitarian crisis, taking that away from Haitians, Salvadorians, and numerous other populations, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, to deport them, the sort of mass deportation force that he imagines. It is, and the cruelty of family kidnapping and separation, there's an unimaginable darkness that's in play.
We're speaking with attorney Bahir Azmi, the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bahir, the CCR is involved in two significant cases, the East Bay Sanctuary versus Barr and the East Bay Sanctuary versus Trump. Tell us about these cases, please.
Yeah, this involves, in addition to the Al Otro Lado case, this involves asylum, what we call Asylum Ban 1 and Asylum Ban 2, not unlike the iterations of the various Muslim bans. 1, 2, and 3. In Asylum Ban 1, the administration issued a rule basically overnight saying anyone who comes into the United States outside of a port of entry, you know, quote-unquote unlawfully, you know, not passing through the customs point I just mentioned earlier, is barred from obtaining asylum. And they initiated this policy suggesting that they wanted to encourage people to go to ports of entry to apply. But we also knew from the Al Otro Lado case that It's not like if you go to a port of entry, they'll let you in. So that was a pretextual justification. In any event, it was plainly unlawful. The statute, the Immigration and Nationality Act, says individuals are entitled to apply for asylum if they, wherever they enter the United States. There may be criminal penalties for unlawfully entering, but there's no bar to asylum, because, of course, Congress knows that individuals who come to the United States are often desperately fleeing persecution and don't always know what a port of entry is when you're fleeing for your life. So then a district judge struck that down, and that was affirmed by a court of appeals, so that was struck down. More recently, the administration passed Asylum Ban 2, which is utterly sweeping and would basically end asylum on the southern border. Under that rule, administration said individuals who simply transit through a third country cannot apply for asylum, which would mean that on the southern border, only Mexicans could apply for asylum, because everyone coming from, for example, the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, where there's just a horrific humanitarian crisis, all of those people go through Mexico. So under this rule, they wouldn't be allowed to enter. And that would, shut down asylum almost totally on the southern border. And along with the ACLU and the Southern Poverty Law Center, we sued again and got that rule at least temporarily struck down. And, we'll see. We'll wait for Asylum Ban 3 and whatever else comes next, because their determination is relentless. I mean, I think we can see this, as you said, Michael, as a promulgation of a vision of a white nationalist America to get rid of these, what they would call, undeserving immigrants from the South. But I think more fundamentally, and you brought this up in your comments about Stephen Miller as a sort of secret Nazi, I think this administration just fundamentally, we really have to let this sit, they fundamentally reject what I would call the post-World War II human rights consensus, that there is a concept of human rights that belong to an individual rather than only to entities from strong states, sort of, a German statist notion of where rights come from, and it's only attributable to certain people. There's the whole idea that, asylum laws were passed as part of the 1951 Refugee Convention to respond specifically to the horrors of World War II, and that consensus has existed for an incredibly long time. Some adjustment on the margins, for sure, but, even in the Reagan administration, some basic commitment to at least not a rejection of those norms. And that's what we're fighting for.
Speaking of the horrors of war, another case on your docket is Al-Shamari v. Khaki, challenging corporate immunity under the Alien Tort Statute for war crimes and torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Congratulations. On August 23rd, the Fourth Circuit Court in Virginia dismissed Khaki's appeal for lack of jurisdiction. Tell us briefly about the case. What's Khaki and who are your clients?
So Khaki is a private military contractor that was hired to provide interrogation services at the Abu Ghraib prison. But as military investigative reports revealed after the Abu Ghraib scandal, they very much conspired and directed the abuse of detainees there. Specifically, in the kind of command vacuum at Abu Ghraib, Khaki took, as interrogators, employees took positions of power and started ordering the military police, including people like Charles Grainer, you remember from the pictures, and Lindsay England, and Ivan Frederick, all of whom were court-martialed for this conspiracy, ordering them to, quote, soften up detainees for later interrogations by Khaki employees. And that produced a atmosphere and an effect of torture and war crimes, as a judge found in our case. Our plaintiffs in this case are four Iraqi citizens who were in Abu Ghraib who suffered horrific abuse that a court said in our case amounted to torture and one of the first decisions of its kind in the post-9/11 era. So they sued. They sued almost 12 years ago. The case has been ongoing and ongoing and ongoing. Pataki has done everything to prevent it from going to trial, including this most recent fifth trip to the Court of Appeals, where we prevailed. And now hopefully, although I'm sure, you know, Kaki may try and delay further, we will hopefully have a trial in the upcoming months, which would be a remarkable opportunity in the post-9/11 era for victims of U.S.-sponsored torture and abuse to have their day in court.
We've been following that one closely, and we're hoping to have you back on soon with a victory report, Bahir.
I would love that.
I would have wanted to shift the focus just a bit here and ask you about the American offshore prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It's been around since just after 9/11 was set up to be out of reach of both American and international law. Our late co-host Michael Ratner, the CCR's past president, led the challenge to the U.S. government's assertion that prisoners at Gitmo had no right to habeas corpus so that the U.S. government could keep them in limbo forever and prevent them from getting a trial. How did the challenge turn out to that practice?
So, yes, when Michael Ratner brought the first case in January 2002, just months after 9/11, he brought it heroically and on principle, knowing that it was unlikely to prevail, although ultimately, 4 years later in the Supreme Court, Michael's vision prevailed, and the court said individuals had a right to challenge their detention and couldn't be held, you know, in a prison outside of the law. That set in motion, you know, years and years and years of litigation, CCR's efforts to obtain lawyers for all the detainees there, and a sort of a mass effort to close the prison through legal, political, and international human rights mechanisms. By 2008, the Supreme Court weighed in favor of the detainees again. President Obama pledged when he was president to close the prison within a year. And since that time, it's been just a really slow, sluggish battle. Obama raced to release as many detainees as he could, although it's his own fault in large part because he took too long and left 41 people there when Trump came into office, when Trump has basically said no one is leaving, regardless of individual circumstances. So there are clients there who have been detained indefinitely without the possibility of a charge for 18 years, you know, almost 18 years, as something close to a life sentence, but without due process, without a trial, and with minimal procedural protections. And it's having really, really predictable effects. One of our clients, Mr. Sharkawi Al-Haj, has gotten increasingly desperate, even suicidal. We've had to file an emergency motion to get before a judge this Friday to have one of our experts visit with him, because the medical care there is atrocious, and to treat individuals with serious mental health crisis, they do the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do, which is take away a blanket or a pillow, punish them for their suffering. So it's a long, hard fight, and there's, you know, very little traction in this administration or even the courts to do something about it. But you know, we remain faithful to Michael's original vision that we cannot have offshore prisons outside of legal process, and ones that we have to observe are reserved exclusively for Muslims.
Bahir, we just have a couple of minutes remaining. CCR has an open records project enabling movement groups to use the Freedom of Information Act. Tell us briefly about that.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning it. You can find it on our website. It's in the Open Records Project, also known as FOIA, which is short for Freedom of Information Act, FOIA for the movement. We think the Freedom of Information Act is a really good tool to empower movement actors and organizers to get information from the government to fuel their organizing, and that's a model of lawyering we've done in partnership with all sorts of immigrant rights and racial justice groups to get information from about FBI surveillance of, quote, black identity extremists, to get information about private prison contracts that will help our movement partners rally against it. So it's a really good tool for activists to understand how they can use FOIA and to reach out for us to us for future assistance in their work.
That's ccrjustice.org. I'll repeat it one more time so you can get a hold of the CCR, ccrjustice.org. Bahir Azmi, it's really a pleasure to be able to speak with you. When you talk about what this government is doing in our name, it's just a disgrace. And to have you on our side reverses that. And we're grateful for the great work that you're doing. Thank you, Bahir Azmi. We appreciate your being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Michael and Heidi. It's a real pleasure, and I appreciate what you're doing with this important voice.
Thank you.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Of escalating U.S. aggression toward Venezuela, anti-war activist Gloria Larriva recently spent a month in that country to observe firsthand the impact on its people. Gloria joins us today to discuss the crucial issues facing Venezuelans, U.S. economic sanctions, the U.S. media blockade, and the people's organizing efforts to overcome this aggression. She'll talk about the Bolivarian Revolution and how Venezuela is holding up under our economic embargo. Gloria is an American socialist activist with the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Peace and Unity Party. She ran for U.S. president in 2008 and again in 2016 with Eugene Puryear and Dennis Banks as running mates. She has been a driving force in the campaign to free the Cuban Five, and a longtime friend of Law and Disorder. Gloria, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Gloria, what prompted you to spend an entire month in Venezuela recently?
Well, yes, I was in Venezuela from February 12 to March 12, and that was in the very intense weeks right after the U.S. named Juan Guaido, who is pretending to be the president. He's calling himself the interim president of Venezuela, which he declared on January 23rd. So I was there about 2 weeks later, and I saw very intense developments. I was at the bridge, one of the three bridges bordering Colombia, on February 23rd, when the U.S. was trying to bring in its so-called humanitarian aid, and the very intense struggle of 15 hours that took place there. The so-called aid didn't get into the country because it was seen by the people and the government of Venezuela as a Trojan horse. And then I was also there for the 5 days of the first electrical blackout. So I was visiting there on behalf of Liberation News to see what was really going on the ground, and basically to counter the U.S. narrative, the media, which says that the country is a basket case, that it's on the verge of collapse, that people are starving and collapsing in the street from hunger. That is not true. Now, it doesn't mean there's not an economic crisis and difficulty. Basically an economic war by the U.S. and the corporations which still control the economy of Venezuela.
Now, how are the people on the ground dealing with this crisis? What's the situation with food, housing, basic necessities? How are they coping?
Well, what's really interesting is that I was on television one time there early in my visit, and I was telling people on TV, well, I'm going to be interviewing people. Please know that that's what I'm doing when you see me in the street. And people would approach me the next days and say, we're not starving. Tell the people we're not starving, because they knew what the U.S. media was saying. Now, the government, to overcome the economic war of actually several years' duration, the corporations, the companies that import the food, they jack the prices up impossibly high. The stores are full of food, the supermarkets, these very fancy stores. The problem is that the price is impossible. So the government began a program 3 years ago called CLAP, C-L-A-P, in which 6 million families receive at their homes a substantial box every month of food, dried goods, in addition to protein, chicken, meat, you know, beef, eggs, at a price that is astounding. For example, to give you an idea, when I was there, the price of a whole month supply of food was 2,800 bolivares. That was equivalent to about 60 cents U.S. dollar. And in the supermarket, it would have cost you 178,000 versus 2,800 bolivares. So that was a way to overcome the food situation. What the U.S. has done now in recent weeks is sanction the companies that import that food for the subsidized food program. In other words, they're not trying to cut off food in the country. They're trying to cut off the food that feeds the people to sustain them, the people who are working class and poor. So the other part about housing is what I think angers the rich in Venezuela the most, because the government has used its oil wealth to build now some 2.7 million homes, modern, beautiful, you know, high-rises that in New York City or San Francisco would look like extremely wealthy millionaire homes. And instead in Venezuela, people are buying them for a symbolic price. I visited those homes. I met many families who were able to buy them for a year or two. And that these are working class people. They're not rich. And so it is a huge, huge support to people who used to live in shacks along the mountainsides, because Venezuela, Caracas, the capital, is really in a very deep valley. And along the high, high mountainsides where people didn't have any means to buy a home, they build shacks that collapse in times of rain. So the government's goal is to build 5 million homes. This means it would house between 18 and 20 million Venezuelans in a country of 30 million. It means that it's a challenge to the real estate industry of the country. So those wealthy people who used to benefit from, you know, profit gouging and forcing people to pay, like we do here, rent and mortgages, they instead, the people are getting housing because it's a necessity. And this is a challenge. It's a country whose government is socialist, but the economy is basically 80% still in the hands of the capitalists.
Gloria, can you talk briefly about U.S. sanctions against Venezuela and what the U.S. hopes to accomplish?
Yes. The legal basis for the sanctions, which is still illegal. I mean, imposing sanctions on any country is illegal and in violation of international law. But the basis for it in the U.S. was in March 2015, when President Obama declared Venezuela to be an extraordinary national security threat to the United States. An absurd charge, completely unsubstantiated, but it allowed him, and now President Trump, to impose further sanctions. At first, Obama had sanctioned Venezuelan individuals who were in charge of security of the country against U.S. Paramilitary attacks that were taking place. There was a lot of violence inside the country in which over 125 people were killed. And so Obama's order sanctioned those individuals. But now it has greatly been extended under Trump, whereby on August 6th, he imposed a total blockade, financial, commercial, economic, in which any entity of the world is banned from doing business with Venezuela, with the Venezuelan government. So even Russia and China, which is doing business with Venezuela, are threatened by the U.S. I mean, the U.S. cannot really act against them as they wish, but they are doing that against banks. Even before the August 6th order, for the last 2 years, the U.S. has blocked virtually every medical shipment. For example, the insulin for tens of thousands of Venezuelans, all the vaccines that the children need per year have been blocked. The dialysis supplies, anything you name, cancer medicines, and the way the U.S. is doing it is by ordering the banks, the international or the U.S. banks, that accept the transactions of Venezuela, they block them from accepting the money. So Venezuela has had to go to the U.N., the Pan-American Health Organization of the U.N., to then do the transaction. But now Russia and China are providing those medicines, which Venezuela is buying, by the way, from those countries. But at least those two countries are not blocked by the U.S. But it's a very severe blockade. The properties of Citgo, which is the oil company in Venezuela, I mean in the U.S., owned by Venezuela, all those properties have been taken over by the U.S., ostensibly for President Interim Imposter Guaido. But of course, it's really controlled by the United States. The gold that Venezuela has in the international banks, in the Bank of Portugal, the Bank of England, that has been withheld, in addition to billions of dollars that Venezuela has in 14 banks. So the country is being encircled, strangled. So what is the country doing? I just spoke with a friend yesterday. There is a major campaign across the country to start producing their own food. 80% of the food has been imported historically from abroad because it is a country that has depended so highly on oil that it was always dependent for decades on imports. So now the communities are growing their own food. The government is trying to provide the tractors, the seed, the fertilizer, everything they need. And my friend said there's very big improvement on this.
Oil is the key word here. Venezuela has the world's most oil reserves, as well as gold and other minerals. But it's an extremely rich country, and I think that it's clear to those people like us who follow these things that the United States wants it. And that's why they want to overthrow the Maduro government, which is a legitimately democratically elected government.
Right, exactly, Michael. Not only does it have more gold oil than any other country in the world, but also more gold. It's estimated to have the highest gold reserves in the world, diamonds and bauxite. It has huge water resources. You know, much of the Amazon is in Venezuela as well. It's also the example that it provides. That's why John Bolton and Pompeo and Trump, that's why they've declared that they will end socialism in Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. And of course,
they call those three countries the troika of tyranny. That's the phrase that National Security Advisor to Trump, John Bolton, invented, the troika of tyranny.
Right. And, you know, people have been asking me, you know, activists say, what about Bolivia? They don't mention Bolivia. Well, the aggression against Bolivia is starting up again. And that's another story for your show. But I want to say this, that yesterday President Maduro declared an orange alert on the border between Venezuela and Colombia. Colombia is being used as the center of paramilitary operations against the country. It is the base of operations from which the U.S. would use for possible military aggression. Already there's a lot of paramilitaries that are being infiltrated from Colombia, but of course we see that President Duque, right-wing president of Colombia, has declared himself willing to help in the overthrow of President Maduro and the socialist government. So there are very serious and menacing developments regarding Colombia. And on August 28th, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, declared the formation of what they call the Venezuela Affairs Unit, which is going to be based inside the U.S. Embassy in Bogota, the capital of Colombia. And in addition, Cucuta is the town that is right on the border of Venezuela from which the U.S. tried to bring in that so-called humanitarian aid on February 23rd. It is a center of paramilitary operation, and the U.S. is bringing politicians, you know, congressmen, diplomats, to come there and make all kinds of declarations against the country. So it's why President Maduro declared Orange Alert, and from September 10 to 28, they will be engaging in massive military exercises in the four Venezuelan states that border Colombia. It's quite serious.
We had Kevin Zeiss on as a guest last month. He was one of many people who were protecting the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., when the U.S. Recognized Juan Guaido as the president of Venezuela, despite the fact that Maduro had been elected. They recognized this imposter, and Guaido's right-wing, white, rich supporters in D.C. surrounded the embassy. The embassy was protected by a group called themselves the Embassy Protectors. Kevin Zeiss was one of them, and under international law, as you know, an embassy is the property of the country which it represents. So the embassy in Washington, D.C. was part of Venezuela. Nevertheless, the right-wingers tried to take it over. They were being protected, and they couldn't be arrested for trespass because they were there illegally. So the Trump administration ordered the cops to come in and arrest people for interfering in a government operation. And we now have a defense committee for the embassy protectors. And I wanted to announce that we're having two of the people that were arrested. They're facing a year in prison and a $250,000 fine. Two of the people that were arrested were Kevin Zeiss and Margaret Flowers and two other people. And Kevin and Margaret are going to be speaking in New York on September 20th at a private home in the Village. If people want to come to it and hear what they have to say and help them in their defense, you can email me. I'm going to give you the email address, my email address, and I will send you an invitation. It's Ms. Smith, that's M-S-S-M-I-T-H 97 at AOL.com. And if you missed it, go get a pen, because I'm going to say it again. September 20th from 6:30 to 8:30 in the Village, we're going to have Kevin Zeiss and Margaret Flowers giving us an update on what's going on in Venezuela.
Gloria, were you involved in those D.C. protests?
No, because I was on a 43-city tour. I traveled to 43 cities in the U.S. after I returned in March. And so I, as much as I wanted to be there, I already had commitments to speak around the country about Venezuela. However, a lot of our people from, you know, the ANSA coalition were there. And I agree with you, Michael. It's so important to support those four who are facing a bunch of charges by the U.S., which has thrown it against them for having done something legal and just to protect Venezuela's embassy. One of them is a friend of mine also here, David Paul in San Francisco, who's facing those heavy charges too. And so if people can go to your event, it'd be great, and find other ways to support them. But no, I think that what's interesting was during that 35 days of the protection of the embassy in Washington, that people were being starved by the right wing, which was surrounding the embassy, preventing the food from coming in a way symbolic of what was taking place in Venezuela and the resistance that protected it for over a month. I'd like to say something else about the resistance in Venezuela. I think the greatest thing to see was people overcoming all the difficulties, and largely because of their organization. Before President Chavez died in 2013, he began and declared that what was needed was for the people in every neighborhood, block by block, to organize themselves in communes. And you see it in the street. The communes and communal councils are basically neighborhood organizations, most of them led by the women. The women are the leading protagonists. And, for example, they ensure the distribution of the food boxes, the CLAP program. They're the ones who are creating these neighborhood centers of bakeries, of centers for the children who are in the street to make sure that they have activities. They're the ones who see, in the midst of blackout, how to overcome the difficulties people share with each other. I was there for 5 days of a blackout, which was very hard because there have been four so far, and it involves U.S. sabotage, a cyber war against the electrical system, what happens when the electricity goes out is that there's no water, because the water depends completely in the country on the water pumps that run by electricity. So when I was there for the 5 days, the faucets did not run. Now, maybe you can overcome it for a day or two, but after 5 days, it was very, very hard for people. So after that first blackout, the government began to distribute these huge barrels that they keep filled with water. You know, these kind of survival mechanisms. And the communities, these councils, are the ones, the first-hand groups that are involved in making sure that people are taken care of. And so every blow brings a new form of organization. I think that's what's important to keep in mind, that the people are determined to defend their revolution, which they call the Bolivarian Revolution.
Gloria, did you have a chance to visit any prisons when you were in Venezuela?
Yes, this was something very, very special. I didn't expect it, but when I took the 25-hour bus ride to the western border with Colombia to help in the I was reporting the people stopping that so-called humanitarian aid coming in. We were there for 4 days because basically there was no gasoline available to come back. And so I was with people who work in the penitentiary mission. It's a ministry, it's called the Ministry of Penitentiary Service of Popular Power. And it was started by Hugo Chavez in 2011, because before 2011, the prison system was a nightmare. It was really basically torture chambers. Historically, the prisons were run by gangs inside the prison, along with guards, and there was great operations of drug trafficking. There were murders. It was really, really terrifying in the women's and the men's prisons. And with the ministry that was formed in 2011, the woman in charge, the minister, Iris Varela, is a remarkable woman who led the complete transformation. They estimate that some 98% of the prisons are completely reformed. And I went into four of them for 5 hours for one day, and then 2 hours another day in another prison near Caracas. I was able to go into the cells of the women's and men's prison. The guards are not armed inside the prison. That's a complete change. And the prisoners were completely disarmed. It was very, very dangerous before. You would have massacres that took place. And how they were able to do it was by convincing the prisoners that there had to be a new way of living. They disarmed them. They have now classes for them, training. They have, you know, preparation for when they leave the prison, for jobs. They work with the families outside to help them come to visit the inmates. And they don't call them prisoner, by the way. They've changed the term to call them people deprived of freedom. Personas privadas de libertad, to say that that's not who you are, it's your condition. But you're not going to remain that way. And, you know, I was able to speak with them alone. I said, I'd like to speak with the prisoners alone. And so they let me interview people. They spoke to me, those who had been there before the reform. One woman said, you know, we used to engage in knife fights. We called it Colosseum, like, you know, gladiator fights. And she said, because they had no uniforms, they used to fight over their clothes. They were left on their own, basically. And she said whoever won the knife fight came out the leader. And now she's one of the leaders of a completely transformed unit. I was amazed. I'm actually making a documentary. I'm in the middle of making it right now to show that if you can transform prisons to humanize the system, what kind of a dictatorship are you talking about?
Yeah, really. Gloria LaRiva, we're coming, sadly, to the end of our allotted time, and I want to give my email address so I can invite people to the Embassy Protectors event on September 20th, and I want to ask you also to give us some websites so they can keep up with your work and the situation in Venezuela. People can write me at mssmith msmith97@aol.com, and I'll give you the details about the September 20th event in support of Venezuela. And Gloria, how should they be able to contact organizations to learn more about what's going on in Venezuela?
Yeah, well, you can see some of my coverage and video and other coverage on Venezuela at liberationnews.org. But there's also a great list of fantastic alternative progressive media about Venezuela. It's a whole sheet of media from Venezuela and from the U.S. And you can get it by going to answercoalition.org, scroll down a little ways, and you'll see you can click onto a whole list of progressive media to find out what's really going on in Venezuela, both in English and in Spanish.
Gloria LaRiva, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you and to learn firsthand what's happening on the ground. Stay safe, keep us informed, and we look forward to having you back.
Well, it's great to share time with you, and a big hug to you both.
Thanks, Gloria. You take it easy.
Take care.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you. Please let us know how you like the show and any questions you have.